Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week wherever you are listening. This is the last episode of this series. I'll be back in the autumn with more episodes. Thank you so much for all your amazing comments on this series and the show so far. I know I say it all the time, but yeah, I'm just glad this show is useful. So thank you if you've been in touch to say how much it's helped. I really appreciate it. And I know I have said it on other episodes, but I'm probably going to be saying it quite a lot until January. My book, You Are Not Alone, as I say on the end of every episode, is out in January and you can pre-order it now. I know lots of people bang on about pre-orders. That's because it makes a huge difference to authors. It counts as the first week of sales and can really, 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 really help. So if you've enjoyed the series at any point or found it useful or helpful, I would be so grateful if you did a pre-order. You can pre-order it from any good bookshop, wherever you like doing your book shopping. And I have tweeted and Instagrammed a link as well. But if you search for You Are Not Alone by Cariad Lloyd, you should be able to do it there. And if you've done it already, thank you so much. This week, I'm talking to the very brilliant stand-up comedian, Ed Byrne. Ed is such a funny person. I have watched him do stand-up for so many years. You would have seen him on Mock the Week and Comic Relief and all sorts of things that he has done. He's been a fixture of the comedy scene for a very long time. He's an incredibly funny man. Ed came to talk to me about his brother, Paul. And as you will hear quite quickly in this episode, his brother had died very recently. I think it was about 3 months after we spoke. So I just want to heads up, listeners, this is a very fresh, raw conversation about some very early grief. And I felt really privileged that Ed had chosen to talk to me about it. So here is Ed talking about his brother, Paul. Ed, who are we remembering today?
Today we're remembering my little brother, Paul.
Paul.
Yeah.
And when did Paul die, or pass away, if you prefer?
He died, it's fair. It's pretty recent. We're recording this 9th of May, so we're not even 3 months. It'll be 3 months on Wednesday. He died on the 11th of February.
So very recent.
I'm still in it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as we say on the show at the time, like, you know, we're all still in it, but you are really at the center of like the grief bomb blast. Mm-hmm. Like it's right there. Yeah, gosh, that is really early. How are you feeling today? Let's start
pretty
there.
Good today, actually.
Good, no, today.
Pretty good, good today. And funnily enough, it's not been a great week. Wednesday and Friday of last week were rough. But it's interesting. I seem to be able to for the most part, control when I deal with the grief. And I was talking to a friend of mine, you know, obviously I spend a lot of time talking to friends of mine about this. And a friend of mine said, have you considered, just because his wife's a therapist, so he's quite into it, he says, have you considered any kind of therapy? And I went, you know what? I don't think a therapist would tell me to do anything different to what I'm doing. I think the way I'm dealing with it is actually really healthy, in that I'm aware that it's bubbling away sometimes, and I can feel like a need to, almost like putting your fingers down your throat when you need to be sick, or squeezing a yeah. spot or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I can feel when it's weighing on me and I need to just bring it on, and I can do it. And music is a massive part of how, so I don't sit and stare at photographs or anything like that. I can just play a song. There are certain songs where I can just stick them on and I will just cry my eyes out.
Yeah.
And whenever I feel like I need to do that, I can just do that.
I think, I mean, firstly, I think you're being really brave in talking about it this early. I really do. And I know that when we initially even spoke about it, I was like, are you sure? Like, this is early. I want to make sure you're okay. But I do think it's really helpful for people to hear how it feels at the beginning. And I read years ago, I mean, therapists, tell me if I'm wrong, that they actually don't recommend you have any bereavement counselling. I think it's like 6 to 12 weeks. I read like at least, because your body's in shock.
Sure.
And so like actually, there's no point having, because you're just kind of in the shock bit. And actually, you do need a bit of time to process personally before you're like, okay, now I could sit down with someone. So yeah, I think if you're in the place now where you, like you said, are aware of it and you can cry when you need to, and you're not feeling like, oh, I can't even exist in day-to-day life, I think that, yeah, that's the best you can hope for.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you mind me asking, like, so how much younger was Paul than
he
you?
He was 5 years younger than me. So, yes.
5 years younger.
He was 44. And it's interesting. For some reason, everybody said he was 45. I tweeted about him, and then I think once that tweet reached a certain level of numbers, it just automatically, any tweet that gets a certain amount of retweets becomes a news story. So yeah, suddenly... Yeah. Newspapers picked up. I mean, even though he was in, you know, he Chortle wrote about him, because, you know, he directed a lot of stand-up comedy and he worked in the business, so he was worthy of you know, of his death being, you know, written about and being noted in the industry. He made the in memoriam section of the BAFTA Craft Awards a few weeks ago, things like that, you know. But the tabloids picked up on it once the tweet had reached a certain amount of numbers, and they said that he was 45, and it was just one of those ones of like, he would find that in its own, on its own, quite amusing that they couldn't get his. There was one guy. There's some, I don't even know who it is. Somebody showed it to me. Some dude who just does a roundup of celebrity deaths from that week, and
wow,
and just has photographs of it. And right from, again, I say celebrity, like anybody in the industry, costumers, designers, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, Paul Byrne died at 45 of lymphoma, which isn't what killed him. And there was a photograph of him. There was one photograph of him, and then three photographs of me.
Ow! Yeah. No, come on, get your photo straight.
Yeah, which again, he would have found hilarious. That has been the interesting thing about this. There's been a lot of laughter. There's been a lot of comedy surrounding the whole thing. Not least when we were planning his funeral, a very good friend of his, Tim Fitzhyam, who Paul had worked with extensively on Tim's one-man shows and on his radio show, The Gambler, he produced that. He phoned and sent, we were planning the funeral, we were talking about what music we're playing, all that kind of stuff. And Tim said, look, I wasn't sure if I was going to tell you this, but I thought you should know that Paul told me that when he died, he wanted to be cremated, which we were doing, and he wanted to roll into the flames to Disco Inferno. And he said, I don't know what you want to do with that. I don't know what to do with that information. So we did honour that wish. And it, you know.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm glad. Well, yeah, it's interesting you say, because I was very aware when he died, because as a comedian, sort of comedian, I, you know, follow people on social media, and I saw this explosion of a person. I didn't meet Paul, mm-hmm. but so many people I knew were posting pictures of him and these huge tributes about what an amazing person he was and the energy and the funniness of him. And I was yeah, it was interesting to be so aware of somebody, as you said, in our industry, which is quite small. Most people do know everyone or know at least one person removed. And there was so much talk of how funny he was. And I think we've had this a lot on the show, like, just because someone's died, they don't stop being amusing.
Yeah.
When they were alive, you smiled when you thought of them, or every story was like, oh, they did this, it was really funny. It doesn't just change because something really sad has happened, something tragic has happened. So yeah, Disco Inferno is a good call.
There was a
lot. Did it get a big laugh?
It did, yeah. And there was a lot of. I mean, my sister made a very funny speech about, you know, the Paul's life and things, and you know, I said just a couple of words, and there was enough. I'm already regretting. There's so much regret is always built in when somebody dies, and so I'm regretting stuff I didn't say at the funeral. Like there was jokes I wished I told, but I wasn't in the mood. My sister did a whole thing about remembering on the serious part of her speech. She did a whole thing about how she had a conversation with him about how she wanted to buy a really cool car, like a Morris Minor or a Ford Anglia or something like that. And Paul had said to her, "No, you don't want to buy a cool car because you're already cool, and you should just get the most ordinary car in the world, a Ford Mondeo or something like that, and it will be cool because it will be your car," which is really nice. And then I got up later on to introduce a song, and I so regret not saying, "What a beautiful speech there by Patricia." Although it does make me reflect on how often Paul would tell me I should buy a really cool car. Now, that would have killed. And I so
it
regret.
Killed. It would have, that been, would have, that would have, yeah, brought the church down. Yeah, definitely. Oh my goodness. So is there three of you, your sister as well? Is that?
And my older brother as well.
And do you mind me asking what Paul did die of?
So liver failure. 11 years ago, 11, 12 years, he just partied hard a long time ago. And I, to my mind, no more than anybody else. Mm. It was like, well, he wasn't like some, you know, hopeless alcoholic sitting at home, bottle of whiskey a day kind of thing. You know, and this is the annoying thing. You know people who drink a bottle of whiskey a day.
Yeah,
before,
fine.
And are fine. He just partied hard and, you know, it was at the Edinburgh Fringe, like 11, 12 years ago, he put himself in hospital with it, just by being at Edinburgh, you know what I mean? At the Fringe and up late and all that. And they said, you've broken this, mate. You can't drink anymore. And then that was it. And he didn't drink anymore. And then 3 years later, he got Hodgkin's lymphoma. And they even said to him, "Oh, just as well you stop drinking, because your liver has regenerated enough that we can hit you with some quite heavy duty chemo."
Wow.
And they did that, but that then put another hurting on his liver.
Yeah.
And then in January of 2021, having been trying to keep a long distance relationship going under lockdown, he got dumped. And it was right when we were locked down, and the industry was in tatters. The Fringe had been cancelled, so I mean that was always his main work, was, you know, working with people and getting their Fringe shows up and running and stuff like that, and that was gone. So plus, you know, he living on his own, so he went on a bender, and he didn't. It's not like he went back on the booze long term. He just, I don't know exactly how long, but he had a few weeks of, you know, of getting over that, and it just broke it again. But then it was one of those ones where you can't really blame anybody. There's so many, but there he was one of those. What makes this whole thing quite difficult is that it was quite a preventable death. And I think the problem was he just always thought everything will be fine. I'll be fine. Don't worry. Like, he wasn't well, and people are saying, "Oh, maybe you should go to the hospital. Maybe you should go to the doctor." And he's like, "They'll just give out to me for the fact that I drank when I shouldn't have drank." And then when he realized, "No, maybe I should," then he couldn't get an appointment at the GP, like probably because of COVID. And he was phoning them up, and he couldn't even get them on the phone. So he went down to the doctor's and knocked on the door, and the receptionist goes, we don't give out appointments in person. You have to phone. And he's like, but you don't answer the phone. And she goes, well, I can't answer the phone while you're standing talking to me at the door. So he sat on the doorstep and phoned the GP, and he phoned 27 times before she picked up the phone and gave him an appointment. You know, and even then it had to be an over-the-phone appointment. And there's, oh, and when he described the symptoms of, oh, great, you're sick. You know, and then everything just took ages, every appointment, everything. And it just, he just ran out of road. So that was kind of how it went. And that's what's really, and there's so many, because there's so many people to blame. There's so many people that you can hold responsible. Ultimately, he is the one who has to bear the most responsibility. But I think he just thought, well, the safety net was there, you know, that would catch him. I liken it a bit to, sometimes I leave shit on a plane. I leave an iPad or a PSP or a phone. And then I realise as soon as I get off the plane, and then I can't get back on the plane, and you're phoning people and they're like, oh no, we haven't found it. I go, no, it was in the pocket of this seat. No, it's not there now. Well, you've fucking stolen it then. And it, you know, and it's like, I've had shit like that just go. And yes, it's my fault I left it on the plane, but now it's somebody else's fault that it's gone. And it felt a bit like that. Okay, so he shouldn't have drunk. He knew his liver wanted, but he just, that safety should also have been there for him. And then it's everything then. It's the people who drank with him. You feel a certain response. You feel a certain anger towards them. It's the fucking flatmate who came home with COVID. He had an appointment with the liver specialists 23rd of December. And his flatmate came home with COVID and didn't isolate in his room. And Paul got COVID. So the appointment got moved to January 27th. And in that was his chance. And in that month, so he was dead by February 11th. So, you know, so there's all these points where of intervention and of prevention, where you thought, if only this had happened, only that happened. I mean, you know, when your liver is fucked and you need a transplant, there's a lot of stuff has got to go right in order for a good outcome. But when you can pinpoint various points where it went wrong, it's very hard not to get angry at those, you know?
Yeah, of course. That's really hard. Because there's a lot of stuff, and I think especially, like we've said, this is really recent stuff. And as you walk away from a death in time, you know, you can let things go easier, or you can see things in a bigger picture. But when you're right in the centre of it, it's really raw and it's really painful. And I think that's awful. That's really awful that he didn't, like you said, that net just wasn't there again and again and again and all those things. And it's very, you know, like you said, like of its time, that moment in time when that was that awful lockdown and we were all isolated and things like this were slipping through the cracks. And at every point, you know, you can understand a, you know, receptionist who's afraid of COVID, who's having 1,000 calls a day, you can understand, but the consequence of an underfunded NHS and stuff like that is somebody suffering like the way Paul did.
I mean, it's absolutely, and again, also the political element of funding and stuff. There's so many different ways and areas in which you can direct your anger and your resentment. And I've been pretty happy to just scatter gun it.
I'm not surprised. Like, anger is such a big part of grief anyway.
Yeah.
You know, someone can just die peacefully in their home and you can feel very angry about it. And like, when it is a death like this where there's these complications, it affects your grief because it's infuriating that people die. Like, that's an infuriating thing, that bodies pack up. It's maddening. That people you love can do that. And then when there are these really literal things you can pinpoint and go, if this hadn't, like that, of course you're furious. That is such a huge part of it. And I think that's going to be, you know, something you have to work through and carry with you and all of that stuff, which it doesn't make the grief any easier because that, you know, sometimes people are furious and like there isn't anything to pin it on. You know, they're like, oh, they got cancer and they died. Like that happens.
Yeah.
That happens. But you do have really specific things you can pin it on, and that's that's really hard.
Yeah,
that's
really
hard.
And I am, so I've done bits about this. I've done material about how I have a tendency to focus on things I wished I'd said and arguments I've had and how I wish they'd gone and stuff like that. So I I do have, you know, fantasies about interventions and all that kind of thing. And then what makes it also further complicates things is that me and Paul had a massive fallout about 18 months before he died. And didn't speak for about a year. So I have that because I have the fact that because I wasn't there for him during the breakup, because we were still angry at each other, that won't have helped. And even though we did absolutely reconcile, there's that huge amount of wasted time that I didn't spend with him, didn't talk to him in that last 18 months. But even if we were getting on, we wouldn't have spoken that often anyway. So there's all that, you know, is going on.
I think what you're describing is just will be so recognisable to so many people, like the absolute levels of grief. And it's really making me remember, like, when you are so, you know, so close to it. And all that happens is, as you walk, you know, I'm 20 plus years now of my dad dying. Everything just blurs and a little bit gets a bit faded, as all memories do. But when you're right in the center of it, all those different complications are so painful,
Yeah.
And that is a lot to carry, Ed.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a lot to carry.
It's weird. Like, my older brother and I are really tight. You know, we're really, and we do stuff together, you know, and we, you know, anytime I'm in Glasgow, I'll always stay at his place, and anytime I'm passing through there. And we have a very close relationship, and I see him more often than I would have seen Paul. Yes, it's weird. I'm just thinking about this. If Stephen dropped dead tomorrow, I would just be sad. It would be easier because our relationship is so less complicated.
Yeah,
there wouldn't be any regrets over things unsaid or things said.
Mm.
And I find that a very interesting thing. That just even though I say it's somebody I'm closer to, but they're lost. The lack of complication in the relationship would actually, I think, ultimately make it easier to take.
Yeah, no, I completely understand what you're saying. I think, you know, grief is really layered, and the more complicated relationship you have with that person, the more layers they are. Like that's just how it is. And then, I think. My experience, and obviously this is my experience as somebody who does a podcast, I'm not an expert, is, you know, like you said, when the relationship is simple, there's a huge amount of sadness to get through. But once you get through that and you find grief, you can kind of, you know, you never work through it. It's not linear. It's not how it works. But it's a simpler process, you know, because you go, well, they knew I loved them. I love that, you know. And I'm very sad they're gone. That's really what we're dealing with. And when there's, like you said, things unsaid and things not said or arguments and stuff, it takes longer, I suppose, to get to the kind of the simple grief, if that makes sense, because you're dealing with all this other stuff. Like you said, all these, the medical stuff, the extreme bizarreness of being in a pandemic and having an argument. Like there's a lot of things before you can get to, oh, I'm just sad that they went. Like the bit where you're just like, gosh, that's a sad thing that happened. And yeah, that is a lot. And I mean, you know, maybe in the future, therapy, counseling, someone to like help you unpick those things. Because that's what, I mean, not to compare, like I had quite a complicated relationship with my dad, and it took me years to get to therapy, years, like 15 years. But when I did, it really helped me go, oh, a lot of what I've been doing circles about in my head isn't really grief. It's like what we didn't sort out between us before he went.
Yeah.
And then once I was able to talk to, you know, have this worked for me, have a therapist who just like helped me unpick it all. And so I could go, oh, I see, that was the mess. And it wasn't really anyone's fault, but here's my responsibility, here's his responsibility. Then I could almost like get to the grief and be like, oh, here's just being sad about that person not being there. But it really does add. More shit.
When your dad died, did you know he was dying? Did you have a time?
Yeah,
where
so
it was
he,
like,
He was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, yeah. but he was dead very quickly. So he was diagnosed in the February, dead by the April.
Right.
So, and I was 15. So yeah. I didn't, you know, I felt like I didn't have
okay.
the time or the sort of emotional intellect to be like, hey, we should have a conversation about these things. And he acted like he wasn't dying. Right. So okay. it was like, right. yeah. Yeah. you know, teenager meets denial is like a really powerful combination. And like my brother's older. And so they had had like, my brother was 19. So they'd kind of got to that point where they'd had a few adult chats of like, okay, as adults, this is why I did this. I'm sorry about this. Whereas we were still in the like fighting stage because I was 15.
Yeah.
So yeah, there wasn't a lot of time to kind of deal with that stuff. And I think when you've got so much to unpick, it's just really hard. And it just adds so much to it. The fact that he had been ill, you know, so you knew he was ill 11 years ago. Yeah. But like you said, to me, it still sounds like it went very quickly from being, oh, okay, you know, he's not very well again. But and that's also, I think we don't give enough space for shock. Like just the shock that someone you thought was, oh, not that well, yeah. is dead. Like yeah. that can happen so quickly. And it sounds like it did happen, like actually very yeah. fast.
Well, I mean, he went into hospital in November. You know, things looked bad then, but that was when it was absolutely confirmed that he needed a transplant. And I was still very hopeful then, and so was he.
Yeah, yeah.
And my family kind of had him written off, because when he first went in, he was quite sick, and I didn't see him when he first went in, but I saw him like a day or two after that. Mm. And everybody was like, had him done and dusted, and I was like, I wouldn't... And that's the annoying thing. Had he not got COVID, I think he could well have gotten past it. So I even said to my mother, I said, I promise you, all four of us will dance on your grave. And I just couldn't make good on that promise. But I that was the last time I saw him was in that period. That was the last time. I spoke to him on the phone since then. But, I mean, I'm really glad I got that time of just hanging out with him in that hospital then, you know. And then it's very gratifying talking to mutual friends and people his very close friends, people like, the comedians like John Hastings and that, you know, who Milo McCabe, Larry Dean, who talking about how happy he was that he and I had reconciled. Mm. So it's, you know, it's good that we had that. So I mean, my overall, you know, sort of how we left it and everything is very positive.
Yeah, and that's really important, and that will be. That will be a really helpful thing with this process of grief because there are people who don't get it. You know, they don't. Like, there's people who suddenly, you know, heart attacks, hit by a car, don't get that chance. So I think that is a really amazing thing that you and him were able to find each other again and reconcile and have that regret. You know, it's important to have that regret. That's how we learn and that's how we grow as people, to be, you know, okay, we shouldn't have done that. That was a waste of time, but here we are again.
Yeah.
There is some serious drilling going on now. I'm really sorry. God.
And now it's funny. It's like, I say I'm in it. But it's like, you know that when you get dumped or when your heart is broken and every song on the radio seems to be a broken heart song and that it's like that trope. There are dead brothers everywhere in the media. Everything I'm watching and enjoying, you know, the last series of Ozark, it was just all revolved around the dead brother. And... You know, I was watching Peacemaker, an absolute riot, laugh, action show. Turns out by episode 3, there's a dead brother involved. Reacher, you find out end of episode 1, I think, oh, dead brother. You know, it's they're everywhere. And then here's an amazing one. So Pearl Jam were a big thing in me and Paul's life. We've been to see them together live. The photograph I put on Twitter of when Paul died, it was me, Glenn, Wool, and Paul coming back from Pearl Jam in Amsterdam on the ferry. It was something that we very much shared. And Eddie Vedder's solo album came out the day Paul died. And there's a song on it called Brother the Cloud, the opening line of which is, I had a brother, now my brother is gone. About Eddie Vedder's brother who died in a climbing accident 2 years ago.
Oh my God.
I don't believe in
a
higher power or any of that. But that's some heavy duty coincidence there.
Wow. Are you able to listen to that song?
Yeah,
at all?
I do, and it's yeah, I, as I say, it's my, that is my method for really just bringing out any grief when I feel the need for it, is listening to is listening to certain songs. And that's not even, it's weirdly enough, that's not one of the songs that'll do it for me. It did make me sad the first time I heard it, but it made me sad more because it's a good album and he would have really liked it and he didn't get to hear it, you know. That's
I know, those like double-edged swords, isn't it, where you're like, oh, it's really painful, but God, they would have really liked this.
Yeah,
they would have been over the moon about this. And I was so annoyed.
I was just texting my mother last night, Eddie Vedder, the last track of the album is a duet with Elton John, who's one of my mother's favourite artists.
Wow.
And just the idea of the lead singer of our, one of our favourite bands, my favourite band, one of his favourite bands, and one of my man's favourite singer, he would have fucking loved that, you know? So it's full of that. And I guess, again, because it's all very recent, it's all very new, I keep doing things that are the first thing, the first time I've done it since he's been gone as well. So they're, and they're funny milestones that hit you in a way that you don't expect.
Mm.
You know? Here's the dumbest one. Okay, here's one that I haven't told anyone. And I can't believe I'm even telling you because I don't even know you that well. And
go for it.
Your listeners are complete strangers to me. I went for my first run just before my 50th birthday, for my first run since he was sick. I used to run a lot and I hadn't been. I listen to music when I run. One of the things that I like to distract myself, because I actually generally find running quite boring, but I do it. I do what a lot of people do. I imagine myself as the lead singer of the band I'm listening to. Particularly if it's things like Foo Fighters, stuff like that. It's
sure,
like,
sure.
You know, I'm sure I'm not the only person who does that. I remember David Sedaris talking about this, and I thought he just absolutely, because not only does he imagine himself singing or playing the saxophone or doing something like that he can't do, he imagines his closest friends and family listening and going, oh my God, I had no idea. I had no idea he was able.
He's so talented. Yeah. Wow.
I thought that really spoke to me, that level of detail. But I would imagine myself, not even playing stadiums, I'd imagine myself playing like Leighton Live at the Gilded Balloon or something like that. And again, you know, all the comments, wow, I didn't know Eddie could play the guitar.
He's really good.
Yeah, because in my fantasy, it's absolutely perfect, because I can't, I actually, but one of the things that I forgot that I do is, oftentimes, when I'm fantasizing about being the lead singer, stroke lead guitarist of a rock and roll band, is I imagine Paul is on the bass. Because Paul actually played bass. He was in a band when he was younger. And I just would sometimes imagine him. And it was the stupidest thing. I found myself doing it whilst on my run, forgetting that I ever used to do that. And here's the thing. There would be a greater chance of Paul coming back to life to play bass for me in my band than there is of me ever learning to play the guitar to a level where I could perform in front of people. So it's completely dumb. But the idea that, oh, that's not going to happen. Like, oh, this fantasy's ruined now. Because it was ruined by your laziness and lack of talent.
Oh my God.
So yeah.
Like, I just really recognise those moments, those grief moments where you're like annoyed at something that makes
no sense.
No sense. And if you took it to anyone, even a therapist, they'd be like, did you want to play guitar? And you're like, no, it's not, that's not the point. It's just like in my head, it was a thing that we did, and now that's ruined. You know, Reach is ruined, Ozark's ruined, the run fantasy of my rock band is ruined. It's just another thing on the fucking list that gets you. And I completely understand that, just because you sort of, I know it's such a painful thing when you have something, it's so painful. But at the same time, it's sort of an outside version of you, maybe it's a slightly comic brain of thinking, what is wrong? That's what you're bothered about. You're like, yes, it is what I'm bothered about.
You didn't see the looks we'd exchange. Just
it was meaningful.
Yeah.
And everyone would come to the gig and go, oh, they're brothers. So when they play, it's like really magic. There's like a magic communication.
There's that point in Freebird where the bass line and the lead guitar really play off against each other. And we really enjoyed that in our fantasy, in my fantasy.
That's very sweet. It's very, very sweet. And I think says a lot about, I can tell a lot about you and him by that fantasy. Yeah. There's a, like a love to that, which is really, really wonderful.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. The shit things that, and that's the thing, like when you're at the start of it, everything's a first, you know, Everything is, and that does, that pain like numbs eventually because you go through so many of them that they become normal. But there, that first year, and we say that on the show all the time, the first year is rough. It's really rough because you're constantly hit with these, oh, I've never done this before, I've never done that. And you've got, you know, birthdays and anniversaries and Christmas, and there's a lot of things to deal with. And you know, I think just don't, not that you are, but you just have to like feel the things that you're feeling and be okay with them and just try and go, okay, that's how I feel. Today I'm crying because of my band fantasy is ruined. And, you know, the next day it's something else. It's something...
Yeah,
you know, people often talk about shopping as well. Like you're, you know, something you see a bit of food that they liked in Sainsbury's, and you're in pieces. And it's the mundaneness that gets you. It often isn't the big things. It often isn't the sort of, you know, you think it's going to be the grand moments, but actually, like you said, it's someone releasing a new album or running along. That just
Well, music is a massive part of it. It's hugely wrapped up in it, and a way that it has been. An incredible way that I found to feel close to him is the last time he was here at my house, it was during restrictions, because I remember we sat in the garden, me, him, and again Glenn Wool, and Paul loved playing music for people. He loved sharing music that you know and going, oh, have you heard this and have you heard that, and he had this big, long Spotify playlist that we put on in the garden. And there was loads of stuff on it that I'd never heard and loved. And then I realised we still have access to his playlist on Spotify.
Wow, yeah.
And there's one, it's like 18 hours long. And so it's great. And I listen to it when I'm in the, you know, on long drives or gardening and things like that. And it is, again, it's a double-edged sword. It's, and I'm still discovering songs on it that maybe I just didn't consciously hear them before, and stuff like where he's introducing me to stuff, and he in that thing up, he would love that, like he would love that I'm still going, and there'll be a song and I'll go, oh, June, Paul, yeah, nice one, and there's some stuff on it that I already know, and I'm like, oh yes, my Cult of Personality by Living Colour, come on, oh, Paul, June, and then there's other stuff that I was like, oh, I didn't know you liked this band, oh, this is a conversation we could have had. You know, so that, and then, but then you can also find yourself poring over it because maybe some of this stuff would have been stuff that you just put together in the last couple of years. And you start going, you start trying to examine, you start looking for clues as to his state of mind, you know, as to, and then maybe you're reading way too much into it. You know, it could. You know, sometimes you just like to listen to sad songs, even when you're not sad. But you know, the fact that I know he went through a breakup, and there's a bunch of quite sad songs on there as well. So you find yourself poring over that. But anyway, it does. It absolutely is far more than I don't sit and stare at photographs. I just listen to music, and that's my way of feeling like he's there. But it absolutely comes at a price because after I've been doing it for a bit. I can feel it then start to weigh. And then I get very... Then that's when the anger comes again. It's like that bit in, you know, the film Misery?
Yeah.
Where he's explaining to her that Misery's spirit lives on, you know, when he's killed the character and she's really annoyed about it. And she's, I don't want her fucking spirit! That... I get that anger, you know. Mm. I don't want to just fucking feel like he's here, you know.
Yeah.
But you have to, you can't, because that's the other annoying thing. The easiest way to deal with it is, at the moment, is to just not think about it.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
Or focus on the times he was an arsehole, you know?
That's helpful, yeah. It gives you a bit of peace from it, doesn't it? Like, yeah. That was really annoying, yeah.
Yeah, or just say, you know, like, okay, so I had my 50th, and he wasn't there, obviously. And I had to console myself with the fact that he probably would have made a fucking excuse and not been there anyway. You know, there's a very high chance he simply wouldn't have made it anyhow. So you sometimes do that to make yourself feel better. And then it's like, well, that's not really being fair to the guy, is it? You know, I'm just pretending he didn't exist, or I'm focusing on him being an arsehole just because I want to keep my cheeks dry today, you know.
But I think that's really important. And I don't know if you've heard of it, there's a theory which I only found recently, and it's called the dual process model, and it's a much more accepted form of grief therapy, counselling, how our brains work. And the idea literally is that you need to oscillate between two states. So you have the grief state, where you are literally like bawling your eyes out, making the weird noises that sound like a goose honking because you're crying so much. And then there's restoration, and that's like you're watching crap telly, you're not thinking about them. And it genuinely says, like, the human brain needs to jump and oscillate between these two states. And when you are doing the not thinking about it, part of your brain is processing, okay, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
They're gone. But if you constantly stare at it, you can't process it. And if you constantly ignore it, you can't process it. And when I read that, I felt like this weight lifting of, like, oh, you're allowed to have a break. Because I think we feel like, oh, it's dishonorable, like if I, you know, think of them badly. And it's like, actually, all of that stuff is your brain trying to process who they were to you, what happened, like how you felt about them, what they, you know, all trying to put all these jigsaw pieces in that you have to do when someone's died. Because that living relationship is over, and now you've entered a world where you are still alive, they're dead, so the relationship does continue because you're there. So it continues in your head, and you have to think, oh, actually, they did do that, and that was unfair, and I'm allowed to be annoyed about that. I am allowed that. Oh, I was bad. Yeah, that was bad.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have done that. Because you're sort of, it's like there's been a full stop in the relationship. But it's not the end. I think that's important to say. It isn't the end because you carry on living, and therefore you will carry on thinking different things, remembering different things, finding out other things. Spotify playlists are such a good example of like, oh, I didn't know they liked that song. And so the grief morphs and evolves over time. But it's so, yeah, when I read that, I was like, oh, because that's actually what most people do. Most people think about it. It gets too much, they have a break. And then they would come up to me and say, oh, I feel so bad. Like, I'm just watching Netflix like 24 hours a day. Or I'm just on my phone. I'm not really, oh, I feel so bad, I'm not grieving properly. And I'd be like, I think you are grieving properly.
Yeah.
I think we just don't treat ourselves with enough kindness sometimes to go, like you said, if you need a day for your cheeks to be dry, have that day.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the thing that will also happen is, you will have a day when they won't be. That's guaranteed. So if you just need a day off, it's totally fine. Or I'd say to people, they'd say, oh, actually, I'm having a good day and I feel guilty. And I'd be like, but you're going to have a bad one. Like, that's going to happen. So don't feel bad for the good moments where you do think, oh, actually, today I'm okay and it's not weighing on me or it's bearable today.
Yeah.
Because the other stuff's coming. It's coming. And you will have to deal with it. So it's never like, you can't cheat it. You can't escape grief. You can't run away from it. And so those moments of like, yeah, just relief from it, I think are really, really important. Mm. Really important.
Yeah. Well, I don't feel guilty about the days. I just feel like as a long term strategy, you can't just not think about the guy. But you're right. So you're allowed, as you say, you're allowed days off. And I you know, that's the other thing. When somebody dies, then other people will start talking to you about, you know, their people who have died. And yeah, and that's like, there's a friend of mine whose dad just died around about the same time. And yeah, he's saying the same thing. He feels guilty when he's not feeling sad. I'm like, you can't feel sad all the time.
You can't physically do it. It's like the thing I always say to people is like, you can't laugh constantly. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, things are funny, then they just go. And sometimes you have a really funny moment. Mm. You know, and you're like, oh, I wish that lasted longer. It was so great. Yeah. It was so nice when we were loving.
Yeah.
Humans don't process emotions for, like, they come in bursts. And that's the thing, grief's the same. Like, the grief comes and then it will go. And that's the only thing I say, like, further down the line. Like, my waves of grief are now, like, there's now, like, 5 years between them. Mm-hmm. But when the first year, there's 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And the waves are like, oh, my God, it's just like, you feel like you're being turned upside down all the time. And then as time goes on, and that's what people mean by time heals. It doesn't heal. It's not a helpful phrase. But what does happen is those moments of grief just get a bit further apart, and you also get used to them. So when I feel something coming now, like a memory like that, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, here it is. This is grief. I know what it is, and I'm okay. But I think when you're that first year, you can often be like, it can knock you sideways, or suddenly you're, you know, 1 minute you're fine, the next minute you're absolutely in pieces. It's a real shit roller coaster. It's not a good one.
Yeah.
You don't want to be tall enough to ride it.
And then I also, you wonder how long can you not use a death as an excuse, but you know, how long before people don't have to give you any sympathy anymore? You know what I mean? like I think it's 3 months is still fair enough that I can say,
oh,
3 months ago, people are like, oh, you still need some looking after, sort of thing, you know. But after a while, it's like, how long can I still go, you know, well, you know, I'm still dealing with the fact that my brother died. When was that? Well, it was like 2 years ago. And the other person would be like, okay, you should really be over that. Or you should at least be over it enough to function in society without having to go, oh, this song or this, you know, how long can I? I'm not saying how long can I string this out for, but, you know, because I was aware, I was wielding it like a weapon.
Of course.
When the day he died, I forgot to get his stuff from the hospital. Like, me and my mother went in to switch him off. We then left, and I realized, oh, you know, it's fucking his clothes and stuff like that. I forgot, and so I just went back to get them. And I would go back, and I'm buzzing the thing in the intensive care unit, and there's a thing on the intercom, and it says, okay, yeah, we'll be there in a moment. We'll just gather stuff and go. So I sit down, and then another woman comes along, and she's buzzing, and I said to her, and she seems really impatient, and she's, I think she worked there, but she didn't have her pass. I think that was the issue. And she's like buzzing, and I go, there's somebody coming, because they're coming to let me in. And she turns and she goes, oh, are you here to visit somebody? And I went, no, my brother just died, and I'm here to pick up his stuff. And she's like, and it is a fucking conversation stopper. It really is. And then I went, and she was just like, and then I went, sorry, I didn't mean to just put that on you. But I fucking totally did. Like, I totally, I was totally just trying
welcome
it out for that.
Welcome to Grief Club, Ed. Welcome to Grief Club.
I was like, why? I'm just going to say this out loud to a stranger. And, it was just a bit like, but it is there's nothing you can say to,
no,
my brother literally just died and I'm here to get his stuff. And you're like, okay, after you.
You go first, it's fine. I'm actually not in that big a hurry now, I realise. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know why I was buzzing. Oh my God, there's grief. Like, there's not, I don't think there's a griefster in the land, as we say, that wouldn't be like, yeah, I threw it down on the table.
Yeah.
I used to call it the, like, the dead dad card.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, there it is. What are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
And when you're 15, you overuse it.
I could imagine you could use that.
Someone's giving you a big fat trump card and you're like, boom. And I think that's like, now I'm older, I think it's shock. I think your body's in shock, and you say it to people, so you see their face and you see them be shocked, and you think,
Yeah, it's shocking, isn't it? This is weird, what's happened. This is strange. But I think you almost need to shock other people. So you sort of like reflect it back and you go, oh, your face is acting like that's something really awful. It is awful. Okay, that's why I feel like this. Because part of you is still going, what? Especially as you said, you know, when, you know, someone seems like they might be okay, or there's all these hope, these little doors of like, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think it's totally fine. And the timeline thing you were talking about is really interesting. I mean, I'm the wrong person to ask, because 20 plus years, here I am still talking about it,
yeah.
Still thinking. And I think you're right. Society will not give you very long, but people who understand will give you forever.
Right. Yeah, that's it.
Someone who's lost their brother will never say to you, still going on about it. They will go, yeah. Because we know to live after that person, especially when someone dies, not in the wrong order, but...
That is the thing as well, because... Mm. And then sometimes I feel bad about that, because, I mean, losing a parent when you're young, I'm sure, devastating. But, you know, parents are supposed to die. Like, that is the natural order of things.
Yeah.
When somebody, it's weird, sometimes when somebody's trying to empathize with you, and they're just trying to be nice, and they're like, oh yeah, it's like, you know, people who are my age, I'm 50, so by, you know, people my age, their parents are dying now. They're dropping like flies in my life, you know, and people are like, oh yeah, you know, I hear your brother died, and I was like, yeah, it's like, yeah, you know, my dad died last year, and I know they're just trying to empathize, and they're just trying to be, I feel like going, yeah. He was supposed to. Your dad was supposed to die. It would be fucking weird if he didn't. You know, going to your brother's funeral with your parents, that's worse. You're supposed to. Your brother's supposed to come with you to your parents' funeral. You know that. And I know it's just fucking.
It's just grief. It's grief. That's what it does. You know that. And you're not alone in feeling that. Like, until I did this show, if people said anything to me about a dad dying, I'd be like, how old were they? They were just 60. Ah, 60.
Yeah.
pretty old.
Yeah.
Pretty old, aren't they? Because, yeah, my dad died at 44. That's when you said that at the beginning. I know it's young. It's fucking young.
Yeah.
And I have got much better. We say on the show, like, there isn't a grief here hierarchy. Like, you know, it's what the relationship means to you. But when you're in grief, that's not how you feel. That's not how you feel. And I think especially like for you as a son, having to watch your parents, you know, go to your brother's funeral, that is not right. It's not right. It's not what any of us expect. And that's something... we mention her a lot on the show, Julia Samuel, who is an incredible bereavement psychologist. Sorry, Julia. She wrote an amazing book called Grief Works, which I talk about all the time, which I can't recommend enough. And she says all the time, like, things that you didn't expect to happen, your brain then has to reorganize it. Like, that's not what was... I wasn't supposed to, like you said, me and my brothers and sisters were supposed to go to our parents' funeral.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen. And then your brain is like, but... And that's what grief is. So much of that is like reorganizing what life has given you. And it's hard and it's painful. And you want to show, no, that's not what I asked for. I didn't order that. I ordered something else. Don't give me this. And it's, that is an added part of your grief. And I think especially when I've talked to other people who've lost siblings, they've described it. It's a bit of slightly invisible grief of like, you know, everyone knows how to sympathize for a parent dying or loss of a child. But with siblings, everyone's like, almost slightly forgotten. It's like over here in a slightly different part of the club.
What I think it also has done is it almost slightly delays your grief, because you're focusing on your parents first.
You're kind of
focusing on the fact that, you know, because losing a child is the worst. Like, that's obviously the worst thing a person can go through as a guy. I mean, I guess losing a parent when you're young is comparable.
No, they say losing a child.
But losing a child has got to be, you know, even.
Yeah.
It's so I'm you know, you're focused on them when it's happening, and then it's kind of like a few weeks later you kind of go, all right, actually, you know, he was my brother and I miss him, you know. I think it just delays it a little bit.
I think that's very true, and all grief is complicated, but it's a complicated position to be in, to have that, to be worrying about your parents, like you said, and then finally coming to your own sadness and being like, oh yeah, actually, what did this person mean to me? I think you're doing amazing. I really do.
Well, the next step is probably to do jokes about it. Like, to actually have it become part of the the joke. And because that was another thing. When I was talking to him in hospital, he was talking about, you know, working on material about it with John Hastings, who's a Canadian comic. Who's,
yeah.
And even then, I'm like, I didn't say it. I'm like, what? Hastings is getting this shit? Hastings is getting the... He's getting the
really good stuff. This is good stuff.
It's like my friend nearly died. Because at the time, because he was worried. Maybe I'm going to die. Yeah. Maybe I won't. But there's going to be material in it. And yeah, John Hastings is going to do that. My friend died or nearly died. I want to do the My Brother Nearly Died show. And I've since... I talked to Hastings about it. You can get the stuff after, you know, went into hospital. You can get it. I'm getting everything led up to that. That's okay. Okay. Let's divvy that up.
You know, only comedians would understand that conversation, but I completely understand that conversation because it's like amongst like female comedians, if anybody has a breakup, the first question is like, it's awful. You will get a show out of it. I really think you will. And like, it's for consolation. You're like, I know. What is it? Well, it's July, so I could do next Edinburgh with it, couldn't I?
Yeah.
Well,
he was he was saying to me, he said, like, he was talking about one of the jokes he came out with to me is that, you know, when I saw him in November in the hospital, and he's like, you know, I realised that, you know, I need a liver transplant. That means somebody has to die for me to live. That's a very heavy thing for me to have to think about, that somebody, in order for me to live, somebody has to die. And then I think, well, three people probably died to make my iPhone. That's a funny joke. You know, and so but Hastings is getting that joke, but I know that there's going to be elements of it. I know I'm going to talk about it. And what's funny is Paul made so many people funnier by helping them write their shows. It was not, he never did it with me. He worked with a lot of, you know, a lot of the time he worked with sort of maybe newer people, but we just never worked together. Right? It was not a thing he did. It's not a service I asked to do for me, but it could be funny. It could be that in death, if I start writing jokes about it, and it becomes part of the next show, that was his way of making me funnier by yielding material.
Do you think you can always hear him being like, "Oh, now you want the material"?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I see.
Oh, now you want my help. Now you want me to be involved in the making of your show funnier. Wouldn't it be ironic if this is the show that becomes my Nanette, and then suddenly breaks?
He'd be pleased. He'd be proud. He'd be like, "See, that's what you needed. You needed me."
he'd be annoyed. He didn't get any money out of it, I'm sure.
I think, yeah. There's no, again, you know, that's the thing with writing comedy and making jokes of things. And I say this a lot on the show, especially, you know, I often got asked at the beginning, oh, how can you talk to comedians about something so serious? And I'd be like, if you look at the world in a certain way, just because someone dies doesn't mean you stop looking at the world a certain way. You know, if you can see humour in things and you see characters and pick up the way people say things, just because you're in a hospital and someone's dying doesn't stop your brain being like, that's weird. That doctor's funny. That's funny that someone said that. And I think there's no harm in that. And I think it's a real, you know, a real joy that comes out of something so awful. And if you can do that, brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And that's why there are so many of these, you know, dead dad shows, as the sort of joke used to be. Because it's like, it's like so shit.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a shit, painful thing. And if you can find any sort of...
Oh yeah,
a pearl in it, then why the fuck not? And then other people can have some relief from it as well.
But it's also how a lot of us do deal with it. Yeah, I mean, we were straight away, as a family, we were straight away, like, I got in the car, it drove us back home again, and my mother was in the back, but my brother sat next to me, and I got in the car, and I just turned to my older brother and said, it should have been you. You know, like, that's how we, you know...
That's very good. Ed, thank you so much for talking to me about Paul. It's been a real honour to speak to somebody who is having to deal with so much at the moment. I think so many people will appreciate that you have chosen to be so brave and talk about it, honestly.
Well, I've enjoyed it. I've found it very helpful. So I appreciate it.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing yourself and Paul today. I really appreciate it.
Cheers.
You can find more information about Ed and all his live gigs and where he's doing his amazing comedy if you head to edbyrne.com. That's edbyrne.com. He's also on Twitter at Mr. Ed Byrne, spelled the same. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was recorded remotely. It was edited by Kate Holland, music by The Glue Ensemble, artwork by Jade Perkin. And remember, even though this is the last episode of the series, we'll be back in the autumn, and you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.